Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
All right, welcome everybody to another episode of Tennis Channel Inside In on the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. Mitch Michaels, Santa Monica Studios, Australian Open into week two. Joined now by Tennis Channel Zone. It's that time of year again. Joining back on the show, established journalist, 60-minute correspondent, John Wertheim, fresh off the set of Tennis Channel Live's two-hour show. John, welcome back, and hope the energy's high because we're going to need it today.
All right, high energy. Good to be here. I'm already... already taking my tie off, but let's talk some tennis.
Yeah, you know, the start of the season every year we do these highs and lows where there's the short off season, everybody hits the ground running, and the first thing I wanted to start with, and I don't know if you've seen it, I've noticed the commentary online and in the media, but the depth of the game has really been striking me as jarring. These first and second rounds, and you know, watching these matches, because the scoreline won't do it justice, but some of these upsets we've seen, whether it's Holger going out or on the women's side, I feel like the players have really taken the match. It hasn't been given to them. And I don't know if it is more resources in tennis or just the quality of depth is better, but I'm starting to see the talent pool widen across both tours.
I think you're right. Hot take. Yeah. This is what happens when you don't have Serena, Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic. I mean, there's to me, this tournament's really a sense of, look, these guys were extraordinary. We could pencil them through to the semis and finals. And you're talking about... you know, four players that among them won more than 80 majors. We don't have that anymore.
No.
And the margins are thin. The other thing, I think you raise a good point on resources. And we have these announcements of the ATP and to some extent the WTA even having this essentially the guaranteed wage and players investing more into their training. Mm-hmm. We were talking on the show, you know, Cam Norrie now has a data guy. Mm-hmm. It would have been inconceivable that a player outside the top 10 had a data guy on staff not that long ago. And I think that the sort of the investment in training and coaching has probably narrowed that as well. But we always used to see, oh, well, the margins are narrow. And what we're realizing is that Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Serena, those are the outliers. Uh-huh. What's much more statistically probable is that two guys, one of them's, you know, number 11 and one of them's number 40.
Yeah.
They may, it's a coin flip sometimes.
I saw a stat, and Demon Hour lost last night. Tsitsipas is still in the top 10. He would have exited with that loss when the Aussie ended. It would have been 58 months in the top 10, which is an insane.
For Steph. Which is great.
We don't bat an eye at that because we're used to what Federer, Djokovic, Serena did in the top 10. So I think that point's huge. I think the other side of it is that players would have tapped out maybe a little early on pro tennis or maybe plateaued and gotten into media or gotten into coaching or whatever, and there's more... you know, incentivization to keep going. So that's the first thing I noticed with this tournament. Got to backtrack a little bit, though. You got the chance to, with 60 Minutes, speak to Novak Djokovic in Serbia at the end of his 2023 season. It's a great interview if you guys haven't checked it out. But, you know, the mind behind the genius and what he said and how he was able to kind of tell his story in that interview is fascinating. I'll start with this. Was there anything that you kind of learned in talking to him about his perspective on things and maybe his motivation on things that you didn't know before?
Yeah, I mean, it was a wild interview in the sense that he was great. He really came to play. It's not often an athlete like that is A, so open about his process, his mentality. I think he is, you know, I think he's a naturally curious guy, and I think in a weird way he's as curious about his success as any of his fans are, if any of us are, and it almost helps him to articulate what's going on. I mean, I think he really sort of relishes talking about his processes because I think, honestly, he's a little mystified by it all. I mean, one thing that struck me, and I don't know if it's a surprise, but just how absolutely devoted to tennis he remains. And sometimes, you know, he's 36 years old. He has multiple kids. He's won the GOAT race. Like, what's he doing? And you say, oh, my God, this guy's motivation is no different. It's no less intense. Than it was 10 years ago when he was chasing. And he said, look, I've moved from this sort of chasing mode to creating mode, but he has found motivation, and some of it is external, right? I want to beat these kids. I like that Carlos Alcaraz blinked and looked me in the eye. Now I can go beat him in Cincinnati and I can go try to win a U.S. Open. I also think he has found motivation just doing things really well. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, again, he's 36 years old. He's got 24 majors. He could retire tomorrow, and most people would say greatest ever, and he's still not drinking beer. It's really extraordinary how devoted he is.
It rejuvenated him, certainly, that Alcaraz, these guys center, are coming up. Hearing him say the stuff about contact sports, about how it is, like, you don't get to actually, like, physically interact, but he'll notice if he's breaking a guy down on the replay or what's in his eyes.
That part
was fascinating. Yeah. There's just got to be no replacing the feeling of being the best at something and being that good at a sport. So I wonder if that's part of it that, you know, what it's like any pro athlete retiring. Like, he's broken all the records, but you're still really good. Where else are you going to find that replacement?
No, it's something all athletes, I think, face. If somebody said to you, hey, listen, you're in your mid-30s, so what, you got 50 years of living, you are never going to be as good at anything else as you are at this thing. You can, you know, go ride a horse. You know, Martina Hingis can go ride horses, and you can try and, you know, open your own fashion studio, but you are never going to be as good as anything ever again in your life. That's pretty daunting, and I think for someone like Novak, he recognizes that and is going to prolong this as long as he possibly can.
Well, he's never better than anywhere else than Australia. He's searching for his 11th record-extending title into the quarterfinals again. 58th major quarterfinal, which ties him with Federer most. Another stat that's like a guy makes 12 quarterfinals in a career. It's like great career, and now he's you know, in the push on 60. But the match against Mannarino was not competitive, and I know we were looking at Ben Shelton as a potential, and Mannarino, to his credit, beat Shelton, but it's like the theme of this tournament, as well as Djokovic's dominance, John, is that styles make fights. And Djokovic just had an answer for everything that Mannarino did, and more importantly, had a strategy for it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also probably helped Mannarino. God bless him. Great point of his career. He's playing the best tennis. He's in the top 20. He'd also played almost 12 hours of tennis and three straight five-setters. And especially at age 35, that's a lot of damage you've taken on when you've been playing Novak Djokovic.
He's getting, I mean, like any player, not just Mannarino, more tired, maybe the fatigue's there, and then Djokovic being the outlier unicorn is getting better as these tournaments go on. He lost the set in the first two matches, clean the last way through, and we know this is the money stages for him, but with Novak's game, and I always caution it with any athlete, like you never know how the young generation is going to push. There are big matchups coming, but same old, like he's just rounding into form in the second week of a major.
Yeah, we've seen this before, and yeah, I mean, Taylor Fritz and Sinner and Alcaraz. So, I mean, you know, there's still a lot of talent in the draw. We forget Medvedev has reached the final of this event twice. But, yeah, I mean, you just sort of, after the first two rounds, well, Novak's a little sick, and these guys are taking sets off him, and there's a wrist injury. And the last two matches he's played, he's been untouchable.
It does feel like with Jannik Sinner, who would be his, you know, he's got a big quarterfinal match coming up against Rublev, but watch the match against Khachanov. Khachanov played very well. Like, that's the one, like, don't, well, you know, props to the Australian Open team for putting those extended highlights on if you missed it, but it really does tell the story that Khachanov was not far off. It feels like a moment for Sinner. Like, he had the momentum last year, got some wins over Djokovic, Davis Cup, round robin play of the ATP Finals. He's carrying that momentum on, and it seems like he's working on the little nuances of his game that I would say give him a chance. It's always going to be a daunting task, but you can't just ball bash with Djokovic. You have to be an all well-rounded player, and I do feel like Sinner's getting there.
I just, it's, to me, it's the one differentiator in tennis that we don't talk about nearly enough is best of three versus best of five, and some of this is just the physicality. Some of it is the fact that you can, you know, you can regroup, you can lose two sets and come back. I just feel like you got to see Sinner do it against Djokovic in best of five. And we, you know, I mean, the play in November was terrific. I mean, I think Sinner's answered a lot of questions, but I think he's also at the phase of his career. Sinner is now where no more consolation prizes, no more moral victories. If he doesn't win this title, I think it's kind of a disappointing campaign. So
this
could be a breakthrough, but it also could be, you know, great November. Let's, but you didn't bring it when it mattered.
Yeah, that's a good point, thinking about that. The last time we saw him in a major, pushed best of five Zverev and lost that match. And that's kind of been the one knock that he hasn't.
A lot of five-set defeats in Sinner's career.
So. Yeah, even if he beats, you're right, there really is no consolation. Like, even if he beats Djokovic, like, lose to Alcaraz or Medvedev, that's going to be a disappointment. Yeah. But the game is there, and he's had the hammer on Alcaraz, and You know, he's somebody that keeps steadily getting better. We talked about it before we started, but Taylor Fritz had last night probably the match win of his career. Definitely in a major, beating Tsitsipas, who 2 years ago, dating back to that, they played in a major, I think it was third round, and Australia. And Fritz was probably the better player, arguably. Lost a couple big points. Kind of avenges that last night. It was a clean match beyond belief for Fritz. I saw the unforced error stats were like 50 to 17. And I don't think he made one. If he did, he made one or two in the fourth set. So this is a player that's not afraid to go for it, but is just playing cleaner tennis. And, you know, it's the process of becoming an elite player that we're starting to see way out.
Yeah, and I think also it's nice to see, because what we always say about mm-hmm. Taylor Fritz, you know, there's a level of professionalism. It's mm-hmm. admirable. The results at the majors just aren't there. He knows as well as anyone that's where players make their bones. Now we've got back-to-back quarterfinals. Yeah, I think you're right. We were talking about it. I mean, he beats Nadal, wins Indian Wells, but we now know that Nadal was pretty banged up. This may have been the biggest win of his career.
I think so. And I think Seth Tsitsipas brought it. There were questions with him. I think he played a pretty good match. He's going to have higher error totals given how he plays on the margins, but there were moments in that match where, I don't want to say Fritz could have checked out, where the going was getting tough and he had to dig deep. And he won it in 4 versus 5. And, you know, it gets him another crack at Novak Djokovic, but more than anything, it gets him success at this major where his, you know, unfortunately, compatriots haven't had any success this year, it seems like.
Yeah, this was...
we talked about the dartboard thing last year. Like, the American man, it just, you know, it didn't happen across the board this year, except for Taylor Fritz.
And weird, you know, in strange sets of circumstances. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting to me that the two best Americans by the rankings earn their keep on the women's side and the men's side. Coco mm-hmm. and Taylor Fritz, as we speak, are still in this tournament. They're going strong. Their number, you know, I mean, these numbers aren't arbitrary. They are the best Americans for a reason. And then there were some really mystifying and disappointing results thrown in there.
I felt like Shelton, to break him each down quickly, that was a test that he hadn't passed before, they hadn't taken before.
Lefty-lefty,
yeah, a veteran. Not going to give you any power whatsoever. Exactly. Paul, he had match points that he didn't convert in the fourth, but it went back to that Casper-Ruud US Open match 2 years ago. Fifth set, he had nothing left.
Right. And I don't know if that was, I mean, what do we hear about Tommy Paul? That he's really been working on the conditioning. He's gotten so much more. I don't know if that was just, I had match points in the fourth set. I can't believe I shanked those two balls. I'm checking out. Or if his body just said time.
I will give props to Kecmanovic. He saved match points before. Seems like a really tough tennis player out there, and the conditioning's not an issue there. Tough to have any positive to say about Tiafoe, though. Like, you have to look at it that way.
I think that Mahach is one of the guys. And people on tennis,
I do like
say,
him,
like,
yeah.
They say, I want to practice with this guy.
He's
this
got
guy's
game.
Amazing. He's got game. He should be ranked so much higher than he is. You'll note, as we speak, he's still in the doubles draw. Mm-hmm. And actually, they beat Ram and Salisbury, the U.S. So this guy's got some game. But, yeah, I was surprised by, if nothing else, that Francis didn't make that mm-hmm. more competitive. Mm-hmm. So those were, and then women's side too. I mean, Sloane Stephens had a chance to get to week two, playing a player outside the top 50, lost the third set. Jessie Pegula, really disappointing Australia campaign overall.
It's good to see Anna Samova back,
Anna
though.
Anna Samova back is a good sign. Yeah,
I don't know if Pegula was sick. There was some stuff she pulled out of the doubles match. There was something there. And just for the Czech stuff, good to see the men finally pulling their weight there. It's nice to see.
Yeah.
Instead of it's just Czech women all the time, that's like a never ending train of just. Maybe it is the coaching, because I've heard more and more tennis people say the instruction. They have a lot of coaches. They have a lot of high end teaching there. That maybe
you're
they just
about
the Czech team,
women.
What's
interesting is they're not. It's not like there's one hothouse. So some come from Brno, you know, or Brno, B-R-N-O, and others are from Prague. And some of them leave the country and come back. It's not as though there's one sort of hothouse academy where they're all coming from. But no, for I don't know, the population, 8-9 million.
Yeah, around there, I think.
It's extraordinary the quantity of top players they're producing.
And not one style either. Like, it seems like they're not. Some serve in volley, some, like Krejcikova, we were watching her match last night, just a crafty net play, everything.
You know, and maybe possibly the best of the lot, Muhova.
Yeah.
Can't even play.
Yeah, as an athlete, for sure.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
More with John Wertheim here on Tennis Channel Inside In, talking 2024 Australian Open. It does seem, though, right, like on the men's side, there's been a few upsets. A lot of the seeds have held. Probably the least we've talked about Alcaraz in a long time. Like, he's there. He's the two seed. But I do feel like with the Djokovic stuff and Sinner making his move, we just mentioned Fritz, and you know, Medvedev's always a character. But it seems like Alcaraz, I don't want to say under the radar, but not being hyped up as much as maybe before.
So you want another hot take?
Yeah, let's
see. We were talking about this on the show. Farrah Fawcett dies during Wimbledon maybe 15 years ago. And you say, well, why didn't I not know that? Well, Michael Jackson passed away that same day, obscuring Farrah Fawcett. I think that happens a lot in tennis. Mm-hmm. You've got some crazy match, or the play goes till 3:30 in the morning, or you've got the longest match tiebreak in women's tennis history. And sometimes it's just a matter of timing. So if Alcaraz plays a night match, it's going to be really, really late. Not a lot of people are watching tennis in the U.S. I mean,
that's true. Yeah, that's probably really it, is that these overnights, if you're playing the night match, the first night on, it's, you know, midnight Pacific, 3 exactly. Eastern. That's the worst time. You're most better at the late one where the East Coast is getting up. But we've kind of just looked at them a little differently, and not that anything's wrong with that, but I think it's, you know, we're impatient, not focused country sometimes, or population of tennis sometimes. And you know, the new hot toy is Sinner right now, and Djokovic is still here dominating, but Alcaraz gets to the final, we'll be right back here and talking about him again.
That's a good point, though. We haven't really, I mean, you know, he's obviously didn't play last year, hasn't done in Australia what he's done at the other three majors, where he's reached at least the semis and won two of them. It's a good point. I mean, for a guy who's kind of the next big thing and has won two of the last, seven majors, it's a little weird we haven't talked about him more.
I love the point that you made. We should might as well just get out of the way about how there's no other sport that would be finishing up at 4 in the morning in any league. And I know that there's different circumstances. I understand that it's a one-off, and you know, the very next night there was an hour where like no matches were taking place, and matches had to go long. It was all this chaotic stuff. It does take away from all the storylines that was only the unfair to the players that accomplished so much that day. That was all that was being talked about. I just couldn't get over that they started this tournament saying we're going to fix this by adding another day. From a logic perspective.
That insulted our intelligence. Yeah. You want to start this tournament on a Sunday. I think most people are okay with that, right?
I mean, French Open does that.
French Open's not everyone can afford or take time off from work, wrap around as many weekends. That's cool, but don't insult us by saying it's to compress the schedule. Like, you're still putting on two night matches.
I wonder, and I heard Sabalenka say, and you know, the idea of losing an off day, it's a debate. I think that's fair, and there's, you know, different ways to handle this. But, yeah, something probably should have been done that day for Medvedev. But he bounces right back, and he's another guy that I don't think we don't really talk about as much how successful he's been in Australia. This is as comfortable as he is anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, last year he lost to Korda, I think, in the third round. But this is a guy who's been to two finals. I also think, boy, he kind of let the tournament off the hook. If he had said, this is absurd, now I have to go to sleep at 7 in the morning.
If he would have lost that match.
If I lost that match, or my wiring, now this is really going to impact me the rest of the tournament. He was really cool about it. The tournament should be sending him a gift basket. He let them off the hook, and then he's back to normal. You know, now he's playing first on the day.
Yeah, too bad. He's a robot that doesn't really need to deal with sleep patterns. That's a pretty good superpower, he said, to be able to sleep wherever. Must be nice. More on the men's side, John, any other thoughts of players still in it before we kind of dip to the women for a bit?
No, I mean, in a weird way, it's been a pretty, pretty formful draw. I mean, there have been some spasm, Nuno Borges beating
College tennis making a move here. Him and Cam Norrie making it so far.
I think there were 29 college players in the singles draw. I think which bodes well for later in the tournament. Pretty, men's side anyway, a lot of chalk. I don't think when Dimitrov losing is a big week one upset. Yeah. I think that tells you something about the form.
That Arthur Cazot kid looks pretty good.
Yeah, I know. Arthur. I hate reciprocal wild cards.
I know.
But in this case, boy, that kid is big. And it's nice to see, you know, the guy's maybe, you know, 5'11" and a 160 and a real shot maker. Yeah. And he's an exciting, I think he's won one main draw ATP match coming in.
It was
week two of a major.
That was one where he beat Holger, he beat Griekspoor back to back, and they were pretty great matches. Yeah, he just Griekspoor was like one and done. Arthur makes me think of Dudley Moore a little bit when I saw another Arthur coming through. No, so
we got Beast and Rindernet. Who said he was the number three Arthur?
Just everybody coming through. Well, the women's side, can't say the seeds have held their weight as much as the men. Iga's loss really, and I shouldn't just pinpoint it on that, but it really was that final House of Cards moment. So many upsets before, but when she went out, Quinn Win Zhang's the highest seed left on the top of the bracket. That's a 12.
Nice player, but that's wild. And I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I feel bad about Iga in part because, I think most of us, you like her personally, you like her game, you like what she's achieved. I mean, I think you could make the case this is the most accomplished player since Serena, and yet, I don't know. I mean, she's lost four of the last five majors she's entered.
Mm-hmm.
She lost to a player outside the top 50. The major she's lost to, she's great on clay, great at the French. The others, she's not even getting to the latter rounds. She's losing to a player ranked number 50. I feel like they're just some...
There's been a pattern here. There's been a pattern of winning the first set and then the dip completely, wheels fall off, and then maybe not be able to handle the pushback. I wonder, and that's obviously the number one point you made, is got to separate clay from the rest. Different player on clay, dominant, has a chance to chase down Chrissy Evert's record. I'm all with you there. But other majors, hasn't happened for her. I wonder if, and I'm not obviously in the camp, and this is just me thinking out loud, she's so good with her plan A, but when plan A doesn't work, where's the adjustments? Where it's like the we see football on with the playoffs now. When they make adjustments, how do you react when you're not doing scripted plays anymore? Niskova, I mean, props to her, 19-year-old, another Czech, but that felt like a winnable match for an elite player if you're number one in the world.
So, and I think, Iga's tinkering with her serve in the offseason. And on the one hand, you say, oh, that's great. She's still using this short window to make adjustments and improve. Martina made a good point, though. She said, that doesn't.
Yeah.
It's a little bit hitchy and what's she doing. And I also think, there was a really telling moment. She's listening to the Rolling Stones. She likes the Rolling Stones. He said, oh, what's your favorite Rolling Stones song? She didn't want to answer. They might make a playlist. Someone might say something on social media. And I'm thinking, this is someone who still is really dealing with everything that comes with being a number one player. This is someone who doesn't go for celebrity.
Yeah.
She doesn't feel comfortable in the spotlight. And I think some of that translates onto the court. And I feel like there's a layer, and I don't toughness is probably too crass. Something is missing. There's a scratch in the facade.
Her level when she's on is the best in the world. Yeah, like I put her into everything. And when, she's a very process oriented player. Yeah. I wonder when the process gets interrupted, whether it's her doing or a lot of times, look, it's just real life, real tennis stuff that happens. The best players that we all mentioned before, they can win with their C-level games. It's all about just getting to the next round, finding a way, figuring out something. And, it's Djokovic serving and volleying against Medvedev in that U.S. Open final down set point. Like, throw this in here. But again, it opens everything up. And, like we mentioned, I did want to mention, though, Quinn Win Zhang, the Li Na comparisons, the symmetry that would be there, the 10-year anniversary, and good to see that she's back in the mix. But, somebody's got to make the final there. And, Azarenka took out the other dangerous player, Ostapenko. We were all singing her praises. But, again, styles make fights. Ostapenko just can't beat Vika.
And keep an eye on Svitolina as well.
Another one,
A former top five player. We all make a big deal out of she's back from maternity leave. What I don't think we talk about enough is what a different player she is. She plays nothing like she did in 2016, 17, 18.
I'm getting vibes of like the Wozniacki Australian Open Championship that she won when she beat Halep that year. And again, Caroline was number one, all this stuff. The draw breaks right. And she keeps herself in amazing shape. And I think Svitolina, now as a fighter, as you said, more improved player, this is an opportunity. And this is somebody that you're not going to really question fitness and get to the final. And then you have one match to win and you're right there.
Just here we go. Roll them out.
The showdown might be set. We're one match away. But this is where if you're ever going to make the argument for reseeding a bracket, it might be this year because Sabalenka versus Coco. I mean, it's more than pencil, not quite pen. We're in that range.
What is that's a good you raise a good riddle. What is more than pencil? No, I think you're right. Yeah. And now obviously would be a repeat of the U.S. Open Final. I think, you know, these are the two highest seeds left in the draw. These are the two players that are playing the best coming. It's been interesting. Sabalenka lost in her match before this tournament started. She lost love in three.
To Rybakina.
I mean, just you come in winning three games in your previous match against a player you played the finals the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of players would say, oh, man, the universe is not smiling on me. And Sabalenka has just been absolutely dominant. And I think, you know, I hate it when people, this match may as well be the final. Well, it's not. And there's different, you know, when the trophy's in the corner of the court, it's a completely different mentality. Mm-hmm. The other player won six matches. I mean, I don't want to call this a de facto final, but I think if you're saying that a likely Coco Sabalenka match is pitting the two players playing the best tennis, the two highest remaining seeds, and the two players who played in the final the previous major. Right. That's the reason to stay up.
The most efficient tennis being played, probably in either draw right now or by these two women. Yeah, and well for Coco, it's very impressive given, like you said on TC Live today, just handling the moment. Doesn't matter, hard draw, easy draw, whatever's in front of her, just my job is to win this match, and she's doing it efficiently, handling the moment. With Sabalenka, I did wonder with her, because she's always been consistent, but will go deep in these tournaments even after she won Australia and have tough times. Maybe this is just a place of comfort for her because she's won here, but also that she just enjoys playing in Australia.
You know what I'm reminded of was with Naomi Osaka. She has this crazy U.S. Open final against Serena, and it makes international news, and it's awkward, and there are tears, and we all know the story. And then she goes, and it's an ocean away, and there's none of the pressure. We were talking on the show today. Coco, Coco went to the movies.
That's a little dark. I mean, no, shout out to the Von Erichs, yeah, but that's a little.
We all like Zac Efron from the musical. But imagine Coco in New York just going to Times Square to like go watch a movie. It never happened. And I think there's something about the rhythms of Australia and the vibe and the fact that you're in the planet's sub-basement that you can kind of reset. And I think for both her and Sabalenka, a very different environment than that last weekend in New York.
It won't be for Sabalenka's benefit, I think. You won't have to worry about a fully partisan New York City crowd, which could help her.
Right.
I said the same thing. We didn't mention him. I should say, like, Rublev last night against Demonauer. I went into that match thinking that if Rublev handles the moment, handles being on the road, and handles the physical conditions. And it wasn't easy, because it hardly is with Andre Rublev in these big matches, but he weathered the storm and his body didn't let him down. And, you know, sometimes it's easier said than done to just go out and beat the crowd too.
Right. I mean, I also feel like sometimes we overstate that in tennis. Like, you know, the Greek population of Melbourne is really going to help Sakkari over the line. You're are they, though?
Yeah.
Are they really? I mean,
I think there was something with Demonauer and his support, though, I being the Aussie guy.
Part of it's Aussie. Part of it, he's real Aussie. He's like your fair dinkum, very much sort of the archetype. But it wasn't like it's not like an NBA game where they've got thunder sticks and they're, I mean, I think, you know.
The movement, too, by the way, like, I didn't have this written down, but it got me thinking, like, the fact that they're letting fans come in on the even games, and some people like it, and some people hate it. I'm fine with trying all things and moving the game along. I don't know if the players knew this was going to happen, I don't see what the issue is. It would be one thing if they just...
I think Jordan Thompson...
I've noticed, I don't want to, like, out certain players, but there's been matches where players have paused, and they've maybe gone to the umpire and been like, all right, can we get this moving? But Thompson was the only one that went outward. It's just getting used to something new is not easy.
Right.
The women's side, though, if it is, you know, you had Sabalenka and Coco, I mean, the name's still in it. It's kind of interesting. Like Jasmine Paolini,
Oceando Dan.
The two Ukrainians, Yastremska and Kostyuk.
Three Ukrainians.
Three, still. Yeah, with Svitolina, too. Like Kostyuk's been playing some pretty inspired tennis, and, you know, unfortunately for her, she's on the Coco section of the draw.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's opportunities there. And Kalinskaya, too, who won that match against Sloane, which was there for the day. I just want to see Sloane have that kind of attitude about tennis again, because she looked good in beating Kazakina and was right there to win this one.
So I'd love to give Sloane truth serum and just sort of say, how are you processing this event? Mm-hmm. How are you accessing this? On the one hand, you beat Kazakina, you beat a seed, you won back-to-back matches for the first time in months and months, and then you lost to a player outside the top 50, a chance to get to the second week of a major. I don't know how that goes down. I mean, Sloane is cool about this, and we've known this her entire career. When she's on, she's as good as anyone. When she's off, it's tough for her, and we got a little of both this tournament.
Before we get to the quarterfinal breakdowns and, you know, big matchups on deck, you brought this point up as well. Unfortunately, could be, and again, Rafa didn't play, but there was a lot of maybe end of eras, end of, you know, careers winding down. We kind of saw on display with maybe Murray, maybe Cilic, maybe Stan on the men's side.
Yeah, I mean, that's a reality of tennis. I think one of the wild cards here is the Paris Olympics. Obviously, for the French players, also for the players in Europe, it's a nice way to end up your career. At the same time, they're not a lot of wild card. You know, it's not as though you want to play, you're automatically in. I think it'll be really interesting to see, you know, Venus, Rafa, even Murray, if there are four eligible players from your country and you are not ahead of them.
Yeah.
It's not so easy to,
like, we're talking about that with the American men. Like, look at, you know, the American men, it's so tightly contested right now.
Yeah, right. So one of the five won't be on that team.
Yeah, and you're talking like Eubanks and Corder be on the outside. Because the top four seem like they're entrenched right now,
right,
but
exactly.
A big result here or there, you know, points to defend, right. We know. It does put it into perspective, right? We talk about the big ones like Murray and, you know, he's just not going to, these guys have such high standards, guys and girls, of themselves that if they don't see it, it's not, you know, Djokovic sees it and he's still out there winning. That's, right. You know, the difference. The quarterfinal side though, John Wertheim here on Tennis Channel Inside In. I guess Rublev Sinner, one that I'm looking forward to a lot. Who's going to break through? Rublev, 10th quarterfinal appearance, looking for that first semi.
That's amazing statistic. And you know that has got to weigh on him. The draw did him no favors. He's playing the hottest player on tour. He's 2-4 against Sinner. I mean, Sinner has just looked so good and so efficient. And even when he's gotten into little patches of trouble, he's gotten his way out of it. Hasn't dropped a set yet. I think that's going to be really tough for Rublev.
And I'll put my analytic hat on, just things I've heard like Courier and other people say, but the mismatch being Rublev second serve, not exactly elite, big returners, big clean ball strikers, have had success in Sinner's case. I think it comes down to how Rublev's serving, but he's playing a train moving downhill. I mean, there's just nothing else to say than that.
And the Sinner.
In Sinner, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a tough one. And then obviously Fritz get another crack at Djokovic. U.S. Open, Aussie Open, like hasn't beaten him yet.
Yeah, Wimbledon.
Wimbledon.
I don't know what. I mean, Fritz has got to serve well. I mean, to his credit, he's not going to break down physically. I mean, I think his conditioning is very strong. I just, you know, Djokovic, best of five, Australia, track record, scar tissue. Mm-hmm.
Let's see some serve plus one tennis. I'll shorten some of these points and go for his shots. And it might take more unforced errors than, you know, you might have to be aggressive and know you're going to make some mistakes. But the beating the GOAT in the best of five, that's the thing. And it's, I don't know if there's anyone, you know, other than the guys that have done it before. Other side of the bracket, I mean, do you think what would be the likelihood, do you think? Like strong chance, good chance that we see Medvedev Alcaraz in the semi, or do you think some fireworks could happen there?
Keep an eye. I mean, is that the Zverev?
Zverev plays Nori.
Zverev's Nori, right.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's ever lost to him. It is a really good point you raise. I mean, we haven't really spoken, you know, Alcaraz started against Gasquet, and then, you know, finally after 200 matches, he played Jerry Zhang, who's
retired in the match,
than him,
too.
But he didn't even get two games. He finally plays a younger opponent. The guy wins two games and retires. Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think this has been a very formful draw so far.
Yeah, it's, you know, Hubie Herkaj, who plays Kazoo, who's another player that...
I may have a little upset pick there.
That Hubie is, I mean, I like Hubie. He's a good server. Hugo and Bear gave him a match, but similar to Egan in one sense, not all the way, but like grass court, he's something special. In the other majors, he's good. Maybe not great. Maybe beatable would be a way to put it.
Yeah, I think he also, I mean... You know, the same, if fans know which players get tight, you can believe that the other players across the net know it too, and you have a reputation for a guy, a lovely guy, nice to have him out here, fun player, but a guy who doesn't necessarily, you know, punch through when it's five all. Other players know that.
Well, I just want to put into perspective on the women's side, we're expecting Sabalenka and Coco to win. Although Sabalenka might have some trouble with Barbara Krejcikova. I say might because she has beaten top players. She's won a major. There's a level of professionalism and a different style there. So maybe, but we kind of said that about Anna Samova and won four games. But, you know, a match for the final and ultimately, John, a title. If we get to that point for either of those two, we're talking the two major club, and that's... You know, Hall something special, Hall of Fame.
Yeah, we're also talking about a pretty compressed set of time. I mean, Sabalenka, yeah, we used to say, well, you never know what you're going to get, and she was a great wild card. She's really buttoned it up, and she hasn't, you know, she's only won only, but, you know, one major, but now she's a lot, I think it's six straight quarterfinals or better.
Oh, yeah, she's been the most consistent by far.
Totally consistent, and all of these sort of wild flights of fancies where she would, you know, she lost to Anna Samova in Australia a few years ago. We don't see that anymore. And, yeah, I think Coco's done a really nice job of backing up her first major win. She said, I think in a weird way, I think people said it, and she said it, and people said, what? But I think it actually really helped her. She said, look, I'm not thinking about back-to-back majors. I'm thinking of winning 10 of these. And everybody sort of said, why would you put that kind of pressure on yourself? Yeah. But in a weird way, it sort of takes pressure off. I'm thinking so macro.
Yeah.
If I lose here, it's fine. I'm still going for double figures.
Two hardcourt majors on the trot. That's like the Naomi Osaka special.
Yeah, exactly.
Just going and the wraparound.
And in the case of Coco, Naomi did both of hers back-to-back, remember?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So, could happen again for her. Wrapping up here, just a couple quick hitters before I let you go. John Wertheim on Tennis Channel Insight. And I do want to you know, join the tennis community in offering condolences for Mike Dixon, the journalist that passed away. I didn't know him personally, but read a lot of his stuff. Pro's pro that a lot of people could say great things about. And I know, you know, your fraternity of tennis journalists could use more and more people like him. And, you know, just want to offer my condolences to his family.
I appreciate that, and I will second that in every way to Mike's family, to the fact that you really miss. This is an absolute stalwart. You'd see this guy all over the world, and just, you know, this wasn't someone who wanted to necessarily, you know, be known. He wasn't a look-at-me social media guy, just a guy who did an honest reporter, good proper journalist, and he'll be missed.
So we want to send our condolences that way. Want to also ask you a couple of questions out the door here, John Wertheim. One, when will we see Rafa again?
Oh, man. That's a great question. I think some of this is health and some of this is sort of planning. You know, I mean, I think best case scenario is this Vegas exhibition / Indian Wells. I don't think he's playing Miami either way. I think realistically, maybe he just shuts it down until the clay. And I think it's strange because in some ways he's got to be really happy with the two matches he won and the level of his play and the level of his movement. And then the third match, another physical compromise. And I think this is precisely what he wanted to avoid.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Some of this is about just what the scans and the MRI and the doctors say, and I think some of this is a lot more strategic about how he wants this year to shape up.
He knows the end is coming, so unfortunately, you know, we're planning out and trying to maximize the minutes that he has left on court, so we wish him the best there. Last thing, I mean, it sounds like it's kind of a good deal, but was Andre Agassi back in the public eye a little bit here?
Yeah, I think this is, I mean, every day there's a
We didn't see him for like a decade, and now he's back.
I don't know what is driving this. It's great to see him. We saw him, apparently he went to Australia twice and did an Uber Eats commercial, and there's a pickleball. We just saw an announcement that he and Steffi, you know, Steffi's been in a bit of an exile as well. They're playing an exhibition with Simona Halep and Andre Pavel. There's talk about him apparently at already plans being made for the U.S. Open. Yeah, I don't know what caused this change in direction and strategy, but great. I mean, the more we can see these beloved champions in the public eye, the better as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, this has been a pretty abrupt shift, and we'll look forward to seeing him.
I'm all about seeing these legends as well. It's good to have him back in the mix. John Wertheim, always a pleasure talking tennis with you. Anything coming up that we should be you know, on the lookout for? Columns, features, anything? Your chance to promote anything you want.
No, we don't. Some fun 60 Minutes pieces coming up Sundays on CBS and some Sports Illustrated stuff as well. But, and of course, tennis.
All right, John Wertheim. And, hey, this is our reminder, too. You know, if you're going to aggregate these clips, try to put them in the proper context because one of us here is an established journalist, and nothing personal against any players that we may criticize too. Just putting the disclaimer out there. John Wertheim, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
This was Tennis Channel Inside In. We're on the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. You can go to tennis.com/podcast and check us out on all your podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, Amazon, to name a few. Check out the video episodes on YouTube as well. We're back in a couple days as we gear up for the final of the Australian Open on the men's and the women's side. It should be pretty good, to say the least. For John Wertheim, I'm Mitch Michaels. Thank you for listening to Tennis Channel Inside In, and I'll talk to you soon.